All right, let's look at the reading. So we're going to start on the 8 verses. And these are oftentimes attributed to Chankya Rinpoche, although it's clear that he didn't just compose them all, but he certainly compiled them. So Lojong, we already talked about, it's to nurture that sensation of, you know, being in the outhouse in Bismarck, of trying to get the heart to you're Lojonging the heart. You're practicing to get the heart to perfection of loving kindness. You're practicing moving the heart into a state of bodhicitta, into a state where it can automatically instantaneously care deeply about others. And these are they call them a dhampa, like a whispered teaching from teacher to disciple. If you've ever had a whispered teaching, it's so beautiful, it's so powerful. Someday your teacher will just come up to you and whisper a line to you. And just the quality of the whispering, it goes into a different place in your heart. It's a very beautiful thing to have happen, to have a whispered teaching. And these have that same quality, these personal whispered teachings. So the first one, it says, "The people around me are more precious than a wishing jewel, a jewel that gives anything you wish for. I will treasure them." Is there another copy of the reading you all have? "May I think of every living being as more precious than a wish-giving gem for reaching the ultimate goal, and so always hold them dear." Now, there's three ways we can think about... There's three things that we can think about as being better than a wish-giving gem. Now, I'm just going to be honest with you for a minute and tell you a quick story. I recently did this 40-day retreat, and my mind, I was trying to elevate my mind, obviously. I was trying to meditate on compassion, obviously. I was trying to do all of these things to my heart, obviously. And one night, just to get a little break, I went out and I was laying and watching the stars. Laying down in the desert is not what it sounds like, because there's scorpions and there's snakes, so you don't really lay down. I actually found a car and I laid like on the roof of the car with some apprehension. It's not like a warm, fluffy place to be. And there's all kinds of weird animals at night. But anyway, so I was laying on top of a car and I was watching the stars and I saw a shooting star, right? And it's like, a wish. And before I could even catch myself, I wished for some weird sexual thing. Right? Like, here I am with, in a sense, with like a wish-giving gem. And I'm like wasting it on I'm wasting it on Preya. It was clearly a Preya wish, right? And I was like, the minute later, I was like, I can't believe it. Like, what am I doing? It was like, and that's exactly what he's talking about. Because he says, listen, I could give you I could give you the annoying guy at your office, or I could give you a wish-giving gem. Which would you rather have, you know? And it's like a no-brainer. You'd be like, I'll take the wish-giving gem, right? But what would happen? You would wish for Preya. You would just increase, I mean, maybe not you, but it turns out, I would just wish for something that would end up causing me a moment's pleasure and then increased suffering. Okay, interesting. No wonder I don't have like what they call cities, spiritual powers. Because I would just get in more trouble, because I'm already getting in trouble with the spiritual powers I have, which is money in the bank, food in the refrigerator, leisure time to think about these things. You know, these are all great spiritual powers. And I'm already wasting my beautiful opportunities and resources. So the first verse here is... The people around me are more precious than a wish-giving gem. Right? And really, when you look at the Sanskrit, when you look at the Tibetan, there's three things that he's suggesting are more precious than a wish-giving gem. The first one is people, and I'll come back to that. The second one is the state of bodhicitta itself. And that's what you very much hear in the Dalai Lama's statement, is you could just drop everything. This whole thing of Shreya and Preya and how to desire and what should I spend my time, you can drop it all and just rest in bodhicitta. You can just, from now on, you can just spend your life working on bodhicitta, trying to understand bodhicitta, working the heart around deeply, deeply caring about other people with wisdom. So the second one is that, and then the third one is Buddhahood itself, right? Buddhahood itself is more precious than a wish-giving gem. Now let's come back to people. You know, I know for myself, and maybe for you as well, I'm materialistic by nature. So I get attracted by Buddhist, I get attracted by spiritual, like, things, right? I want to surround myself by spiritual things, by like nice rosaries. I think I have like 5 rosaries now, like, because my mind is dissatisfied with each one. It's like, no, this one's really special. Oh, but this one, you know, so I have like these things and these accoutrements and, you know, my bell and my dorje and all these like ritual instruments that I surround myself with, like religious iconography and stuff like that. And what's being said here, right, is that the only ritual instruments you need, the only ones that really matter, the only ones that will really help you are annoying people. You know? And they're cheaper. You know, and as far as I can tell, they're inexhaustible. You'll never run out. You know, and they'll do more for you than the most beautiful mala. They'll do more for you than the most beautiful rosary. And why will they do more for you? Because they will always keep you in the market. They'll always be pushing you to grow. They are your mother and your father that are just pushing you to grow. And you think, no, they aren't. They're just an annoying person. You know, you have no idea who they really are. It's very possible that they actually might be some kind of enlightened being that are pushing you to grow. The proof that that's a possibility, can you say that proof that that's a possibility is that you can't disprove it. That the most annoying person in your life could just be some kind of angelical being that's trying to just push you into the marketplace. But even if they're not, they still function the same way. Even if they're not like some, you know, you don't even have to buy that. You don't have to have faith in something that far out. Even if they're not, they're the only ones that are really pushing you to grow spiritually. Because if you separate yourself from society and you just live in a cave and meditate and you have your malas and your spiritual pictures, it's much harder to really stay in the marketplace, you know? Because you don't have anybody that's annoying you and you can just think loving thoughts about everybody. You know, there's a famous story of a hermit meditating up in the woods, and he'd been meditating for like 30 years, and another monk comes and, you know, in the middle of his meditation, he like knocks on his door. He said, "How's your meditation going?" You know? He's like, "Quiet, I'm meditating," you know? He's like, "Oh, sorry. How's it going now?" You know, and he keeps bothering him, and finally this meditator comes flying out. He's like, "Would you leave me alone? I'm trying to, you know, meditate." And he just says, "I guess it's not going so well, you know." And you know, they say that it's one thing to be able to meditate for years by yourself or something. It's a whole other thing to be able to be patient when somebody's pushing your buttons. And they say that's the real mark of a spiritual master. You know, like, okay, you can hold headstand for, you know, 12 months and, you know, not use the bathroom, and you can bring your prana up to the top of your head and make your eyes glow with light. But can you hold your patience when somebody's really pushing your buttons? And that's the mark of a real spiritual master. So the people around you are more precious than a wish-giving gem, right? Do you hear that? It's not a metaphor. It's not a metaphorical. It's literal. Because if you had a wish-giving gem, you most likely would wish in some form or another for something that would just give you more suffering. But if you have difficult people around you, if you have annoying people at your office, you should really bow to them. You should prostrate to them because they are the ones that will get you to a different level. They're the ones that can possibly get you to a state of enlightenment. They're the ones that can move you closer and closer to a Christ-like state. And try to get that into your heart that that's not a metaphor. It's a real statement. It's a true statement. And so when you see these people, particularly when somebody suddenly, unexpectedly shows up into your life that is just, it's bad timing that they show up, and their manners are inappropriate, and the way that their voice comes out is irritating, like you just should have this innate instinctual feeling of, ah, what a great fortune, you know? What a great fortune. Very hard to practice. When Geshe Michael taught these, he said, you know, he taught, you know, people logic and all this incredible stuff, emptiness. He said, trust me, these are the hardest verses I will ever have to teach. They're the hardest things I will ever have to teach you. Because the mind just can't, it can accept it on one level, but it just resists it at another level. Particularly, I think, verse 5, which we'll come to. Here's one I resist. I first started reciting these verses in 93, and I skipped this one for probably 8 years. Because I just didn't agree with it. And here's the verse. When I'm with another, wherever we are, may I see myself as the lowest, may I hold the other as highest from the bottom of my heart. May I see myself as the lowest, and may I hold the other as highest from the bottom of my heart. Now the reason I didn't want to recite it is not just out of some kind of pride, but because it felt inaccurate. And the reason it felt inaccurate, I was trying to be as real as possible with my spiritual life. And I felt like it was impossible that I was the absolute lowest on the planet. You know? Like, I that just felt like, I still don't feel like that. Am I the absolute lowest person on the planet? So I reworded it. I was like a teenager, and I reworded it. I still have that original copy. I was trying to find it for this retreat, but I couldn't find it. But I reworded something like, when I'm with another, wherever we are, may I see the possibility that I am lower than them. Something like that. You know? And may I hold that possibility from the bottom of my heart. It was something like that, you know. And that felt like, okay, that's more accurate. At least so I can engage in you and I can just say, it's possible that certainly that I'm much lower evolved than you. But to just say, I am the lowest, it felt like the joke I said about like, oh, dear God, you know, like, forgive me for I'm your lowest servant. You know, it felt like a fake kind of a humility. So I skipped it, and then all of a sudden I got a more accurate teaching on it. And now I say it quite joyfully. And here's the teaching I got on it. It's not so much, it's not that humility, oh, I'm nothing, you know, I'm horrible, I'm just your lowest creation. It's holding in mind the possibility that in this room, I am the only one that hasn't reached some kind of angelic realm. Right? In this room, I'm the only one that hasn't reached the higher level of evolution. Which I know sounds weird and new agey maybe, but it's a beautiful thought when you really sit with it. So I was just traveling with my teacher all through China and Singapore and Taiwan, and we were teaching and teaching and teaching, and he was doing a lot of question and answers, and one woman raised her hand and she said, you know, he was using this example of where did my pen go? You know, this example, which many of you have seen, is like, what's this? It's a pen. What would it be to a dog, right? you wiggle it in front of a dog, and the dog would see it as a chew toy. So this exists both as a pen and as a chew toy, right? And it's the same thing as the table. It is empty of having a penness. If it had a penness, then every single being would see it as a pen. It would exude pen from its own side, right? So pen would come out this way. It would be like pen would be projecting from here. But instead what's happening is you're projecting pen onto it. This is just a pattern of energy. It's a cylinder, a pattern of energy. Even the color, even it's empty of color, right? But we're projecting red pen onto it. A dog would perceive it as something else. An Eskimo from the 4th century would perceive it as something totally different. So he was talking about this idea with the pen. You know, and then he talked about, like, my teacher was saying, for me, this pen is an immense potential. I can write about emptiness, right? I can teach about emptiness. In a sense, this object is one of the highest objects that I can conceive of. It has that kind of sacredness to it. And the more he teaches it with this pen example, the more I see him treat pens with this absolute reverence. It's really beautiful. Like, he sees one on the floor, he's like, ah! You know, it's like as if it's holy scripture. So he has this relationship with pen, you know? And no matter what a dog does, a dog cannot conceive of it as a pen. A dog's mind can't get to that level, you know? It just, no matter what, a dog cannot get to that level. No matter what you do, like you can draw, a dog cannot conceive of language in that way. And in a sense, we are the same way, right? To think that we are suddenly just the highest of all beings, it might be a little species-centric. I don't know if that's a word, but that suddenly we've reached the pinnacle and there's nothing that we can't conceive of, you know? But in the teachings, particularly in the Buddhist teachings, they teach that that's in fact not the case. And in the Christian teachings, that there's a whole nother realm that we can't see in the very same way that a dog can't even imagine the use of a pen. Right? In the very same way that a dog can't even conceive of the existence of a deeper, like, spiritual realm. There's a whole nother realm that we can't conceive of. So this woman raised her hand and she said, how can I teach my dog about pens, what a pen really is, right? And in my typical negative judgmental mind, I'm like, oh yeah, I wish he hadn't opened up for questions because that was the dumbest question I've ever heard, you know? And he's pausing up there and I'm like, you know, I've been hanging out with him a lot, so I feel like I can pretty much think what he's thinking, and he's like, God, what am I supposed to say to this dumb question, right? And all of a sudden, I see like a little tear come down. He said, that's the most beautiful question I've heard in years. And I'm like, dope. You know, I was like, what are you, that's the most beautiful question you've heard in years? Like, how can I teach my dog how to use a pen? Like, am I missing something? Like, what do you mean? And not only does he think it's the most beautiful question, he's crying because it's so beautiful. I'm like, oh my God. I missed something, you know? And then he said, what the question is how can I move to a higher level, you know? How can I get somebody to move to a higher level? And he said, it's the hardest thing, you know? It's the hardest thing to inspire somebody to move up to a higher level that they can't even conceive possibly exists. And it reminds me of a friend of mine. I was teaching in California, and a friend of mine said, hey, do you mind if we go try to find my son? And I said, no, what do you mean? She said, he's a meth addict, and he lives on the street, he's homeless. And I just try to catch up with him every couple of weeks and give him some money and make sure he's still alive and stuff. So we drove around the streets, and we're looking behind buildings and stuff, and finally we find him. And there's this really handsome, really beautiful, like, 24-year-old kid that's just out of his mind, you know? Pockmarked, and just that sense of just out of his mind. And he's got a pregnant girlfriend behind him that's mumbling to herself. And so those two are talking, and I'm just kind of leaning against the car, like about the same distance as Jane and I are. So I'm listening to their conversation, and I'm just watching the scene. I'm watching the agony of the scene, right? The agony of a mother trying to get her son to rise up a little bit, you know? It's the same thing of trying to teach a dog about, you know, a pen or another level. The son is that far gone. And at one point he says, Mom, would you leave me alone? I'm happy. You know, would you leave me alone? I'm happy. And suddenly I thought, well, wait, who are we to tell him that he's not happy if he's telling us that he's happy? You know, it's a tricky thing. But yet we can both see that he's not happy, that he thinks he's happy. But, you know, he has this weird, twisted perception that he's fine. But he's really desperately not fine, you know? And they say that the enlightened beings kind of look at us in that same way. And we're trapped in that same zone. Like, I started to see him as having this bubble around his head that could only see, almost like blinders, that could only see to a certain point. Like, I don't even feel like he saw me, you know? His vision, he was so, like, just high and in his own world, his vision just stopped at a certain small bubble around his head. And when you think about some kind of spiritual experience, oftentimes it's the expansion of that bubble, you know, to include other people. And when this woman that was totally high and out of it asked me to use my cell phone in the grocery store, like, you could tell she couldn't even see anybody around her. You know, it's just like she never even saw me. It was just this kind of, like, you can just feel it as this, like, jumbled sense of reality, you know? But to himself, to this young man's sense, he was seeing all there was to see. You see what I'm saying? He was seeing all there was to see. There was nothing, no other reality. There was no great, you know, he was, I'm happy. Here's my mom bugging me, you know? And to us, we are seeing something totally different. So the question is the same. How can you take your son, who's a meth addict, and try to rise him out of that state? And here's a bright woman, went to school for psychology, was a social worker, had no idea how to do it. You know, how do you do that? In the same sense, it's a question for us. How can we recognize that we are some type of meth addict when we can't even see it? How can we recognize that we are in that same bubble state when we have no perception of ourselves not in that? How can we long to get to a higher state when we can't even conceive that the existence of a higher state exists? How can we get to a higher state when we can't even conceive that there is the existence of a higher state? And one of the ways to start to do that is in verse number 2. And it's not about humility. It's not about anything like that. It's about the trying to bring to your mind the realization that, in fact, you might be the lowest one here. You might be in a state that, you might be in some low state that you can't even conceive of. When I'm with another, wherever we are, may I see myself as the lowest. May I hold the other as highest from the bottom of my heart. And in that sense, even the most annoying person, you would start to listen to their words to you as almost like scripture. Even when somebody asks the dumbest question you've heard all tour, you would suddenly open your mind and say, man, it's very possible that I'm the lowest person in this room and I just can't see it, you know? So that verse is, and for me it was so nice to hear that, because what I worried about with that verse was some false sense of humility, you know? It smelled of that a little bit, like, oh, I'm the lowest and I'm horrible, you know? But it's not, it's something much more beautiful. It's that I have to recognize the possibility that you all are kindly being attentive, just to, like, poor Will is just slowly trotting along, and he'll get it eventually, but he's still got his meth bubble over him, you know, and just keep looking attentive, and eventually he'll break through. So I have to recognize that that's an extreme possibility. So the third verse. As I go through the day, may I watch my mind to see if a negative thought has come. If it does, may I stop it right there with force, since it hurts myself and others. And You know, we wake up in the morning and we have an agenda. And our agenda has all the things, mostly, I would say for most of us, I think it's fairly safe to say our agenda is mostly in the realm of prayer. It's mostly in the realm of making a living. It's mostly in the realm of, securing some kind of level of comfort and happiness for ourselves. And then when somebody comes along and gets in the way of our agenda, it's a slight annoyance, you know. When somebody like rear ends us, you know, like have you ever had that happen, or like somebody hits you in a parking lot, you're like, you might be late to work, or it's like, oh boy, you know, and there's anger that arises. All of these things come up. This verse is asking us to switch our perspective, and every time that happens, we realize that that is our agenda, right? It turned the whole world upside down. Every time we have some kind of inconvenience, every time somebody annoys us, that is what we woke up for. That's the person we've been waiting to meet, because that is our chance to actually do something that will bring us real pleasure. And what is that thing that we're being asked to do to bring us real pleasure? It's to realize that that situation is coming from karmic seeds we planted in the past. It's another opportunity to realize that we are stubbing our own toe. And it's so hard to practice that, right? It's so hard to even conceive of practicing that. To face it and admit it's your problem. To face the situation and admit that it's your problem. And again, we need a strong foundation of emptiness, we need a strong foundation of karma to begin to even imagine that it's possible that that's our problem. But then, if you're not at that point, if you're like, well, that's not my problem, that person rear-ended me, you know, that's their problem. You know, even if you're at that point, you can still say, well, which way of viewing the situation would function more? Would it function, when I say function, right? What do I mean by function? I mean which situation would open the heart more, or which situation would close the heart? So would it be more functionable to say that that person hit my car and they deserve to be punished for that, you know? Because here's I'm just talking about in this little realm of the heart. Forget about what's true, forget about what's lawful and all of that. What would it do to your heart? Would it be more functional for the opening or closing of your heart to hold that person responsible for inconveniencing you? Or to hold the possibility that the only reason you got hit today, right now, was because of some seed you'd planted in the past? That it's the ripening of some carelessness that you had done in the past? You see, when you move it out of the realm of true or real or any of that, you know, you realize that it actually functions more to have this other worldview. I was recently flying from Tokyo to San Francisco, and then San Francisco to Phoenix. And I landed in San Francisco. And, you know, I had my flight booked. The flight was all booked, right? And I assume that they give you enough time to, like, transition, right? And sure enough, they didn't. And I got so mad at the airline, you know? I got so mad at, like, the travel agent, right? I was like, that's so frustrating. Because, you know, I come into San Francisco, and it turns out I have to leave the terminal, get all my luggage, then I have to go through customs, you know? And then I have to wait, and I get to the line where I have to get back into the airport, and it's like a 2-hour line, and I have 20 minutes. And I'm just like, argh! You know, it's like, why do they book international flights? Like, you know, and I was so mad. So the only thing I could think, I really didn't want to miss my flight, so I actually just bypassed the whole line and went in the little section where it says, like, airline staff. You know, so there's like two pilots and me, and they're kind of looking at me, and I have no like badge or anything. And I was just so desperate, I just did it, and nobody said anything. And they're like, next, and I went right through, and he's like, kind of looked at me and they said, okay, and I went through and I barely made my flight. So anyway, a week later, I'm still ruminating about this, right? I'm still mad about this. And I'm like, you know, I should really just write a letter to the airline